Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Welcome to the latest episode of the El Arpa podcast. Joining me in studio is Mary. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
That's good. So I want to congratulate you.
Why?
Because you were fantastic in the book presentation. What book presentation? Our book presentation.
Well, so are you.
Thank you very much. And also a special thanks to Mercedes Fisteos, who you might know from a previous episode where where I interviewed her. Because you were in Egypt. I interviewed her about her book about Salem, the Salem Witch Trials. She wrote a novel, won an award, and was a fantastic interviewee, and also was a fantastic presenter of the book launch as well. So, Mercedes, if you're listening, thank you. And we already thanked you in person, but here we are thanking you in the podcast. We had it in Casa del Libro in Gran Vía. Which was, well, it's a central location. It's a well-known bookshop. It was a huge honor to be there. And how did it go for you?
The same as for you, really well.
Yeah, I mean, I know that, but for the purposes of the listeners.
Yeah, so yeah. No, it was a nice experience, and it was good to get a chance to explain everything that the book is about to the general public, and people were really into it, and asked some interesting questions, so all in all, it was quite good.
That's true. Last around half an hour, Mercedes presented a book. She gave an introduction, her thoughts on it, and then we answered her questions, and as you said, we finally answered questions from the audience. We got a tough one potentially at the end about, like, if this is a book about history, how come we're talking about Donald Trump and Brexit? And I stepped in to answer that one, and I was like, Brexit... Brexit is historic in its own right, and so is Donald Trump's presidency. But we won't bore you with what we answered, but I think we navigated that nicely. How was it to sign your name so many times in the book?
Kind of weird to be signing books for people you don't know, but no, people were really nice and very keen, so no, that was a great first contact with the public.
And also they came up to us at the ends and also asked us questions and spoke to us personally and thanked us for writing it. Or maybe I imagined that last part. And two of my students turned up as well. So that was nice. Thank you very much, boys, for crashing the party. And so all in all, hopefully an experience that we get to repeat, no?
Definitely.
Okay, great. Love your enthusiasm.
Fake news part two. There's always going to be fake news. So
more fake news every day.
There should be plenty to write out.
And also, we've just uploaded a blog post. Not about the presentation as such, but you can find now our blog post about fake news, the book we wrote in Spanish. So if you are an English speaker wishing to practice their Spanish or a Spanish person who's listening to us to practice their English, I think either camp will find something of interest in this Spanish translation of the article there. And also, we have an event coming up in 2 weeks, which is the St. Patrick's Day Bonanza in the Artistic Metropole. And more of that as we get closer to it, which is very close already. And get buying tickets. And we're gonna have Melanie and Porik
that have no surnames.
I was very careful this time, but check the previous episode for that. And we're gonna have Dennis Rafter, who is confirmed and is very
has a surname.
Exactly. We're looking forward to that. And then we're gonna hear a couple of stories and the Gwell Gores as well. So before we go to part two, speaking of Irish, you have, and I have discovered as well, Irish Twitter. And how hilarious it actually is. Minerals. What are minerals for the benefit of the non-Irish listener?
Fizzy drinks, according to you.
Exactly.
As I found out this week.
Yeah. Yes, it is. What else has captivated you about the Irish Twitter? All of it.
No, well, at the moment, it's a very interesting initiative because it's a Huelga week, basically. Or it's a week where the language gets promoted and there's a book called History of Ireland in 100 Words, which we are aiming to get hold of. And it just, they've put banners all over Dublin, apparently, and they just have the word and the explanation of what it means in a little illustration. So they're really nice. And then what they're doing on Twitter is basically they're just saying, tell me your favorite Irish word, and then you enter into a competition of Irish goodies, which we're going to do because we want the goodies. And we have plenty of Irish words that we like.
Speaking of banners, briefly, apparently Dublin City Council have sent out a lot of fines and notices to companies for putting up murals around the city. One of them is our friend Blind Boy. Put up illegally by somebody, they're going to take it down. But speaking of Irish as well, you sent me a great poem on Friday from the author of the book Mother Folklore.
He translated it
yeah, into Irish. Yeah. And stunning piece of stuff as well. But just seeing Irish reactions to Brexit or just mad things that happen all over the world. It's definitely, I think, the best social media platform at the moment.
Oh, I came across a very funny thing about a bus driver that I think it was in Cork. I'm not entirely sure, but that he basically like got off the bus to feed a horse because he said that apparently there was a horse that like, you know, wasn't getting fed enough or something, and or some friend of his like had asked him if he could feed the horse. So basically just in the middle of the road, he just got off and fed the horse for about 10 minutes while everybody was waiting and then kept on going.
Well, what you have to understand is that this...
Now for the anthropological explanation.
No, I'm just trying to defend my people from like this paddywhackery.
I thought it was quite charming. I didn't think it was stupid.
Exactly, because you have to understand, like, bus drivers have the same route every day. So he probably saw this poor horse starving on a daily basis, and that his well of empathy grew bit by bit until he couldn't take it anymore. And I like to think that all of us have that capacity for compassion once we're confronted with that on a daily basis. Yeah. So it's an inspiring story. Hashtag feed the horse. Okay, so, well, thank you so much for all your inputs so far, Mary. Don't go anywhere. We're going to be back for part two. Part two has arrived, and we'll say one more thing about the books before we move on to Rodan and Naughty Pictures. So, here's your fantastic idea to...
Thank you.
You're welcome. to record videos promoting 10 chapters of the book, 30 chapters in total, but we're going to just promote 10 of them. We've just written the script for the Salem Witches one, and you spoke about Cleopatra.
Yep.
And we did that in front of the Archaeological Museum. 2-minute video, in and out. And how was that?
It was good. I got the idea from some promotional videos I saw for books. I can't remember what they called them, but yeah, something like video book, something like that. But it wasn't, I don't know, I thought it was a bit strange because it was like a slideshow, and it was... There are companies that actually do those videos for you, and all you do is just, well, there's nothing. It's just like a photo of you and a few lines of the book, about the book, and some music, and then it just says where to buy. I don't know. I just thought it was a bit plain, because if you can explain, obviously, for example, with chapters, it lends itself more to that. But even if you have a full novel, you can just explain some key parts of it. And I think it's more engaging for the person to, for the potential buyer to hear the author talking about the book.
Correction, co-author.
Well, yeah.
It was very dynamic. I was there. I was doing the introduction. You were doing the main part, and I was there again for the conclusion.
Yes.
And we changed the camera angle once or twice.
Well, but this week we're going to do it the other way around, so...
Exactly, yeah. So, so we'll be posting that on social media, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. And, just find us, we'll say that in Part 3 as well, but find us there, and you'll see those videos and how big-budget Hollywood they are. So I mentioned to you as well off the microphone that I saw this video from the BBC Ideas about how stories impact our minds and our brains in a physical way, but also in an empathic and emotional way. Now, I told you that, well, Harry Potter, have you ever read Harry Potter?
Not really. I studied, but I just, for me, it's like, it's too boring. I know a whole lot of people are going to kill me now, but...
It's okay. Twilight?
I haven't read it either.
That's fair enough. Apparently, according to a study, if you read a couple of chapters of Harry Potter, and this is a self-reporting group for a scientific study, you feel that you know, compared to the rest of the population, you have...
You can fly.
More of a potential to move objects with your mind. And if you read Twilight, or at least a couple of chapters of one book, and you're self-reporting to this experiment, you feel like your teeth are slightly sharper than the rest of the population. That sounds mental, obviously, but...
Yeah, it does a bit. And also, I'm wondering about why people are interested in having sharper teeth.
I guess vampires. There's a vampire exhibition in La Caixa.
True, but you don't want to go.
No, I do want to go. I mean, from an anthropological perspective,
we want. I wonder who says that.
No, that was you. We have to
exactly.
We have to examine the sexualized dimension of vampires.
That was you.
And other things. It's not advised for people under 12. So I wonder what's inside there. The exhibition.
Vampires.
Vampires. Very gruesome. Pictures, yeah. Or something, I don't know. But it gets a lot more interesting, this study, because in this video, because they talk about how kids in Sweden, if they read Harry Potter, they have a more open attitude to immigrants. Now, there's a caveat here. They have to identify with Harry Potter already. So that begs the question, like a cart and horse situation, you know, or chicken and egg, which comes first? As in...
No, carrot and donkey.
Any iceberg lettuce and hamburger bun. I don't know, anything that you want. Are they already empathetic, or has the book made them so? Or has the book just amplified what was already there? But
yeah, well...
You think that's what happened, no? It's not that...
Well, I think that's what happens, of course. You need to be in...
Already...
In a certain environment that favors that type of thinking. Of course, there are going to be cases where people lean towards that, even if they're in an environment which is hostile to that. But I would say the majority are probably already in that kind of environment.
Well, you do hear stories, though, of people who are like neo-Nazis or something, and they hate Muslims, and then they read the Quran so they can educate themselves about, you know, in quotes, the enemy, and they end up accidentally converting themselves.
Yeah, but I think accidentally converted them.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think like those people, I mean, people that have like extreme ideologies, like they tend to be quite insecure in their own like beliefs in reality. So they're susceptible to being convinced of an extreme ideology, then they're also like susceptible to a different one because they just don't have strong ideas. Like if they did, they wouldn't have to resort to, you know, extreme methods and beliefs.
Well, that
in
is,
my opinion.
No, I think that's true because we've spoken before on a previous podcast about a couple of neo-Nazis in America who are anti-Semitic and anti-African-American. But just because they spent some time with a reporter from the UK, they broke that down quite easily. And over the course of their interaction, they became firstly... more open to African Americans, and then ultimately not anti-Semitic either. And it's quite interesting, this type of, you know, you just need to reach out to some of these people and their heart, well, again, in commas or in quotes, their steadfast beliefs tend to kind of ebb away, you know. But then again, you have other stories. There's a great documentary from DW, which is a great German platform. You can find it on YouTube, about a Ukrainian guy who was a neo-Nazi, and he fell in love with a woman who was a feminist anarchist. And
great combination.
Yeah, but like, he had his beliefs like that certain people couldn't fight properly, and then he fought the Russians, and he discovered that, you know, gay people could fight and defend the motherland and things like that. I mean, obviously, according from his point of view, he didn't think they were capable of that. But then he saw it firsthand, and his attitudes completely changed. So it's all about exposure and just getting people with these unhelpful ideas to just be exposed to kind of the truth. And as you said, they're either insecure and these ideas fall away very easily, or just the weight of the evidence in front of them can kind of dismantle it. But then again, people go the other way and this double down. And that's really the story of fake news as well in our book, which is the last mention of it today in this podcast. But like, once you're confronted with the truth, you choose not to believe it. And we said that in the presentation as well, that very often fake news is a choice and you choose to believe it. But I think there are other factors at play, to go back to what we were talking about regarding stories and how they can improve your life. They say that your relationships are obviously very important in your life, but they don't have to be real ones to have a sense of purpose and a sense of fulfillment and happiness. If you have friends in the books, or you read a lot, the characters that you identify with, and this is a whole process, you have assimilation, transportation, and identity, how gradually you take on these characters' traits or empathize with them, and also get transported to their worlds, like they can fill the holes in your life that real people can. And what's interesting is like that if you also read the word jump in a story, the part of your brain that's activated when you are jumping yourself, well, that's activated when you read that word in a book as well. And they say this is like because of mirror neurons. So what we're seeing with these stories is that people read them and it's fictional. Or maybe not. I mean, maybe you're reading a history book and you identify with the people as well. But we interact with it to such an extent that it's almost real. And because it is real for us, it becomes something greater than fiction. And that has some kind of tangible, emotional, and philosophical and intellectual benefits for the person reading the book. So I don't know. There's a lot going on there when you're reading a book. But a lot of surprising things, I think. At least for me. I don't know. You seem more dubious or doubtful about it?
No, I imagine we're talking about this in the context of like children and teenagers.
No, also adults.
I love the way you just approach us to say that. Okay, well, no, I mean, I think, you know, of course it opens a whole lot of interesting worlds, and I was just a bit worried about the relationships thing that I suppose, you know, as long as that doesn't replace, it's the same as like the internet, no? As long as that doesn't replace sort of like real face-to-face interaction with other humans, then should be all right.
Well, of course, but it's not like social media, which feeds a toxic loop of information. Books are, I think, considerably healthier. And yeah, I mean, the idea is that you have these real relationships, but
talking in terms of socializing, because
yeah,
in the end you can, I don't know, like I remember I used to go to class with one girl that she'd read a book and she wouldn't like lift her head to say hi to you, and she could be there reading the book and you were there waiting to start the class 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and she wouldn't like talk to you, and then she said, oh, the book is more interesting. Well, you know, I don't know. I think, of course, I am the first one to enjoy getting into a book and being transported to another world. But I think, well, you know, you need to do it like in a... don't let it replace like the social world, you know. As much as I hate being social, as you might know.
I think what you say is true, but I think they're not talking about those people who, it's not really a question of socialization, what you just mentioned, that's a question of manners and not being an ignorant person. But like, I mean, but point, the point is, like, I mean, Harrison Ford, for example, who's in the news this week. Not Harrison Ford, Clint Eastwood. They're all the same.
Wow, that was like, yeah.
No, he used to work on a farm, and he used to escape into his mind with his stories because it was a very lonely existence. And the idea is, like, yeah, obviously it's better to communicate with people as well or have a balance. But for those people who are in a position where that's not entirely possible, then it does do a lot
to
really alleviates loneliness as well.
Yes, I agree.
Ignorant clowns notwithstanding.
Yeah, of course. Okay. Fair enough.
So,
it's okay, she's not going to be listening.
Or maybe she is, who knows. But speaking of books, I told you as well, and we've touched on anti-Semitism very, very briefly. There's a book I told you about, no?
Yes, about a Jewish footballer, but I can't remember his name.
His name is Bela Gutman.
Oh, yeah, Bela. We've talked about this.
Yeah, it's very strange. It's a name that I knew from an Irish soap opera, actually. I never knew it was a Jewish name, but I do now. And it's this book my brother gave me for Christmas. And, it's just, as I told you last week, it's just three stories in one. On one hand, I never imagined, and hashtag it's not a football podcast, but the debt European football owes to Jewish coaches and footballers is absolutely immense. The first coaches of Real Madrid and Bayern Munich, two powerhouses of European football, their first coaches to win trophies were Jewish. The originator of the European Cup, which is now the Champions League, which is the competition in the world, the premier club football competition, was also Jewish. But the book is more than that. It's just a story of anti-Semitism down through the centuries. And the book is structured in such a way that each chapter follows the progression of his life. And this is a guy who, you know, he was playing football in Austria on the day of Anschluss, you know, when the Nazis came into the country. He's a guy who came from Hungary, which was quite right-wing and pro-Nazi during the war, who hid out and escaped from a labor camp over the course of the war, and then escaped from Hungary and became an Austrian citizen before the onset of the Cold War. And his family perished in the camps, you know. So, and each chapter is structured around like a historic story of anti-Semitism that somehow links to the main story, sometimes directly, other times not. One story that struck me was the one of this boy who, of these Jews who are accused of killing Christian kids. Now, of course, in our book, Fake News, we talk about Simon of Trent, who was murdered by somebody. We don't know who. But Jews were blamed for that, and that led to a huge pogrom that extended beyond Trent and across Europe. And he mentions an English boy who was also murdered, and the Jews were blamed for that, and we mentioned that in the book as well, which is linked to this the area of Norwich in England, and also their house was taken over by a prominent Nazi. The name is, if I said it, you'd recognize the name if you're interested in the Second World War, but it escapes me now. But also just the stories of people who were referees during European Cup finals or were footballers. And then the next line is, and then he got killed by the Nazis. Or when they were in the ascendant in the 20s, when he's playing for a Jewish team, Hakoa, how they would play in different parts of Hungary and other parts of Eastern Europe, and Jews would flock to see them because they were an example of this awakened Zionism. I shouldn't say Zionism has a connotation these days, but an awakened Jewish identity, which is very healthy considering that they were a targeted group for thousands of years. And then the author will say, well, yeah, most of the people who filled that stadium, that area got completely demolished, wiped out, or became a Jewish ghetto during the Second World War as well. So it's just this incredible story of this guy's life, other people's lives who come in and out of the book, and the author mentions that you could write several books about these people because they all lived a thousand lives in a sense. The story of European football, the football lore, he coached Eusebio. He won two European Cups with Benfica, put a curse on them after he left over a dispute with money. Died in poverty. And it's just a story of one man going to America, because we went to the exhibition of American immigrants. That was our last podcast. He's there at that time as well, and he's making a name for himself, investing in a speakeasy. So it's like, it's just, you know, and other stuff we've spoken about in previous podcasts coalesces. Joseph Roth, his book Job, going to America. These just time, the 20s and 30s in Europe and in America. Again, as I said, this guy's life, in a football sense, in a personal sense, but also as well a history of anti-Semitism and the Jews and their struggles in Europe. And it's also just, it's fascinating and horrendous by the same token, because I never realized until I read this book that even after the end of the war, it took so long for the word Holocaust to emerge. And, you know, even for a year, 2 years after, maybe a little bit longer, Jews that came back looking for their houses that they were dispossessed from were either beaten or murdered or chased out, accused of murdering Christians, and basically were still victims of pogroms and anti-Semitism. And you told me a staggering thing I never knew, which is about when they came back to Berlin, the electrical companies, if you want to take up the story there.
No, just that they made him, this was in a podcast from the BBC, that this discussed how perception and attitudes towards Nazism have changed or have evolved in Germany since the 50s. And yeah, it just mentioned how basically on top of like taking them to the concentration camps, some of them they kept on using their houses and for their own benefit. And then when, if they managed to ever come back, or even if they did, they would do it to their families. They would just send in the bills for the electricity and you know, whatever water, whatever bills they had run while they were in concentration camps.
Yes, that's an awful story. So all I can say is it's a great book. On another day, on another podcast, we could talk for longer about it. But hopefully that summary grabs your attention. Even if you're not a football fan, I think there's enough in this story to really pull you in. So yeah, so Bela Gutman, a hell of a guy. And finally,
is that the name of the book?
You know what? I think it should be. And finally, we'll just mention that we went to see a Rodin exhibition, The Thinker. Now, I mentioned this to you, this fun fact. It was a short-lived magazine called Playgirl, which was, how should we say, erotica for women. And Sylvester Stallone was The Thinker, which is one of Rodin's most famous pieces. And when we were there,
I don't see you doing the motion.
I know, but it has me inherit the character. And then these were kind of sketches. They were quite bad. Well, no, you know.
You cannot say that about, you know, world-famous artists.
I can't. I just did.
Well, it was just wasn't a cup of tea, but, you know, I suppose...
Ever the diplomat.
I suppose you... Yeah, yeah. I suppose you have to look at them in the context of the time. It wasn't like, you know, now we're so used to... We're so exposed to everything, you know, the human body and everything, like, has a... sexual connotation of some kind, and at that time, I suppose.
What are you talking about?
No, like, I mean that, you know, like, it's like films, like, there's no, you know, like in the Western world, like, there's no like censorship anymore with that kind of thing. And then at that time, sort of like doing that kind of study in a way of anatomy of the human body, don't give me that look, would be, you
I'm
know,
clutching my pearls,
a novelty, as in, you know, like, now we just find it, well, so what? This is like no, but, well, it did not, I mean, for me, it wasn't interesting because it didn't really add anything to my knowledge. It didn't really like.
So you're very knowledgeable of the.
No, but no, when I speak in Spanish, even. No, I just mean that, you know, you have to take it in context. But that said, probably the exhibition would have benefited from, you know, further explanations of how this translated into this culture, which it did, because he did mention how sometimes these drawings were believed to be the basis for sculptures, and other times they stood on their own. But personally, to be honest, we're not so much into sculpture of any kind.
Or nudity.
Are we? Or nudity, for that matter. So
that is our thing.
So, like, you know, it was like...
Okay, well, speaking of soft core sculptures, we can finish with a nice story. Your story about Amore Isike.
Ah, okay.
Okay, so this is a sculpture that you absolutely love, and also Daphne and the Hunter.
Well, yeah, Apollo and Daphne is my favorite one.
Yeah, and you tell a beautiful story, had me in tears, so take it away.
No, well, these are Bernini sculptures, and of course, you know, we're talking a completely different type of sculpture, and to me, it says a lot more because it's just full of meaning, not only because they're portraying mythology themes and stories that are familiar, but also because they're very lively. There are some amazing sculptures as well. In Canova, for example, they have like a veil, and like a thin veil covering different sculptures, even like it's just like you're distracting me because you're smirking. It's amazing, you know, and there you can value really how amazing it is to be able to work the marble in a way that makes it look like it's a piece of material. And for me, like, technique-wise, that's amazing. And the other ones also, like, tell a story. And in Apollo and Daphne, it's like, she's almost like, you can see her running away. So it's, like, static and full of motion at the same time. So for me, that's very impressive.
But also in the morning. Cupidence and Psyche.
Yes, I thought you were going to talk about that.
Well, it's an interesting sculpture because you told me this is about the Greeks having an ancient conception of the mind, and it represents the mind flying away, and something about Egypt and death, and I don't know.
So basically, you didn't listen to anything I said.
I'm just trying to set you up for this, you know?
Yeah, well, this I'm going to tell you in the next podcast. I'm not going to tell you now.
Okay, so tune in next week for more sex and nudity in the ancient worlds. Thank you for listening to part 2. Up next, part 3. And we're back, part 3. So you can find us on LAPRA1 on Twitter and our blog, irishsliceofmadrid.com. Also, you can find us on Patreon. And also regarding our tour, yes, you can find it on Airbnb of the old shopfronts and Lab of PS or different platforms. And regarding more specifically our event for St. Patrick's Day, that's what I wanted to get to. What are the platforms for that?
Well, you can just check out Twitter or our Facebook page, and you've got all the info there. Or I drop us an email at larpamedia@gmail.com.
Exactly. It's Gmail, gmail.com.
com.
On the old interweb. So thank you very much for listening for another exciting installment of the Larpa podcast. We will be back next week or the week after.
Shlan.
The Alarpa Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.